smaller group today. We do have a number of members who weren't able to make it, unfortunately. But we will proceed anyway. And, you know, just as a sort of preliminary here, we do have to get our report into the larger commission, the Healthcare Access Commission, at the very latest by the morning of December 15th. So after today, we have just one more meeting. And so it's my plan to work with staff to put a draft together so that at the December 8th meeting, we can at least be sharing it with all of you and getting your comments before we would finalize that. And we're still, of course, all working through this and working on how we want to present it and where we're going to exactly go with it. But right now, it's sort of my intention to at least reference some of our discussions, even if we're not putting them forward as recommendations, because obviously there are a lot of things that we've talked about here that, you know, mean a lot to different people. And, you know, we certainly want to honor the work that we've done here together. And I really feel so positive about this group and working with all of you. And I think that it's really a shame that we have such a short time, because I think there's been a lot of value in this process, and there would be more value if we could continue. But sometimes, I guess, having limitations is what actually makes you do this stuff, right? So I guess it's a good thing. So on today's agenda, we're going to start out then hearing a little bit about Merck. And is Diane Ritterich, I don't know how we pronounce it, if you could come up, please. So we're going to hear a little bit about Merck funding and how that relates to workforce shortages or workforce issues in healthcare. And welcome to the work group. And if you would just introduce yourself, and thank you very much for being here today.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Diane Ritterich, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Division of Health Policy at the Minnesota Department of Health. For the last 10 years or so, I've also been, as part of my role, the Director of the Merck Program. Mm-hmm. So, I have a lot of material to cover, and I understand that there's not a great amount of time, so I will go through some of it quickly, and some of it is fairly technical, not being sure of the background that some of the people on the group have on Merck, but I'll try not to get too bogged down in the details of it. I'm going to walk you through just the beginning points of Merck and some of the early history, talk about the original goals of the program, how it's changed its shape and its distribution formula over time. What types of providers are eligible for it, what the distribution looks like in the average year, and how some of the changes that have been put in place related to Merck in the last few years have affected that distribution. And I'll end with just a couple of policy questions that the group may want to consider. So just a brief timeline. Merck began with a directive to the Health Department in 1993 to study medical education and research costs, to identify the annual costs of each of those components, and to determine how those costs should be allocated throughout the system. The idea at the time was to use assessments on group purchasers to support medical education and research. This study led to the formation of the Merck Task Force in 1995. And just as an aside, there are a number of people who were involved in that initial task force in 1995 who are still very involved in Merck today through its advisory committee. So we have a very deep bench on Merck. I'll talk about the details of what came out of those task force recommendations in a moment, but just the quick timeline. As a result of the recommendations of that task force, the Merck Trust Fund itself was established in 1996 with a standing advisory committee to advise the department on medical education. Merck was first funded in 1997. At the time, it was funded through a $5 million appropriation from the general fund, $3.5 million from the Access Fund, and then those funds were matched through the Medicaid system. So it ended up with roughly $18 million for that first distribution, which occurred in 1998.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Yep.
Do other states do this too, or is this unique?
Minnesota is unique. There are a couple of other states that have novel ways of distributing medical education dollars. New York has had an innovations fund in the past. I'm not sure if it's still operating now, but it was for a number of years where they incented certain types of providers. And Utah has been really a leader in having a more interesting approach to funding GME, graduate medical education, in their state, and redirecting both their Medicare and Medicaid funds to incent certain types of training.
Thank you.
I won't talk too much about the sources of funding for Merck, but it has changed over time. The general fund and access fund appropriations were only in place for a couple years. After that, it was funded through the tobacco endowment, and then when that was no longer available, it is now funded primarily through the cigarette tax. The MDH receives just over $8 million a year through the cigarette tax. Those funds are matched through Medicaid program. And then we have this last piece, the last bullet point. In the year 2000, we received authorization from CMS through a federal waiver to carve out what's known as the graduate medical education add-on payments from the PMAP program. So those were medical education payments that were designed to be passed through to facilities that were doing medical education. It was not clear whether that pass-through of payments was happening from health plans to those providers. So the state received authority to carve out those funds, direct them to MDH, and then distribute them to training providers through the Merck program. And I'll talk in a little more detail about that in a moment. The original Merck goals, at the time when Merck was developed in 1993 to 1995, there were obviously some of the same concerns around access and cost and quality at that time that there are today. We were also at a point where managed care was really starting to become embedded as part of the care delivery system in Minnesota. And there were a number of concerns related to increased competition and whether training providers, education providers, would be able to pass along their higher costs associated with training and reimburse those costs in any way. There is funding for medical education through the Medicare program. It doesn't generally cover all costs, and it's not available to all providers. So Merck was set up directly as a way to offset that lost patient care revenue for teaching institutions who, in the absence of that, would have to, can't think of a better way to say it than eat the costs associated with that higher cost structure for providing medical education. And I use the term medical education here, but as you'll see in a moment, we're really talking not just about medical education, but also nursing and pharmacy and dentistry. But you know, the name of the program is medical education, so I tend to use that shorthand. The guiding principles of Merck, at the time it was established and still today, are that medical education is a public good. It is something that benefits all Minnesotans, not just the facilities that are doing the training and not just the patients who are being seen by those students or residents, but the entire state has an interest in having a well-trained workforce, a sufficient workforce that's distributed appropriately around the state. The theory behind Merck was that the cost of medical education should not be borne only by a few hospitals or medical centers where that training is being provided, but it should be fairly allocated across the entire system. That's the reason why the initial funding for Merck was through the Access Fund and the General Fund. If the general public and all users of the healthcare system benefit from having a high-quality healthcare workforce and a high-quality education system, all should pay a portion of the costs of that. And another point to understand that I think is relevant, although I don't have a bullet on here, is the idea that money should follow the training and should go to the places where training occurs. Another trend that was certainly well underway in the early and mid-90s and continues now is the fact that healthcare is provided more and more in outpatient settings and relatively less in inpatient hospitals. It was and is more difficult for ambulatory sites to receive graduate medical education funding. So Merck was established as a way to offset a portion of the costs in those settings, with the understanding being that if physicians and nurses are going to be delivering care in clinics, in offices, in rural areas, in ambulatory settings, they should be receiving training in those settings as well. And so this was a mechanism that would allow funding to follow those trainees to the clinical sites where they do their training. Oops. So the Merck Task Force in 1995 laid out several guiding principles for Merck that I'll just talk about quickly, because I think they are relevant to this group. The first was that teaching institutions should be responsive to evolving workforce needs related to the mix of specialties, the mix of generalists and primary care versus specialists, and the mix of professions. One way that Merck responded to that in the early 90s was with the addition of physician assistants to the program, which was a relatively new profession at the time. The healthcare workforce should support cost, access, and quality goals of the state, and that the state should use public policy to incent certain types of training, to promote the training of generalists or primary care providers, to resolve geographic distribution issues and deal with shortage areas, and to influence the gender and the racial diversity mix of the healthcare workforce. Although they felt that facilities should be left to determine the strategies to achieve those goals themselves, it was important for the state to have goals related to the makeup of the healthcare workforce. I talk a lot in here about numbers of FTEs and types of providers. So it's important to note, as I said, that Merck applies not just to physicians, but to a number of provider types. It provides funding for programs that train physicians. So that can range from med students who are doing their clerkships in their third or fourth year, up through residents and fellows who are completing specialty programs. Doctors of pharmacy residents and students, dental students and residents, chiropractors, advanced practice nurses, which includes nurse midwives, nurse practitioners, nurse anesthetists, and also physician assistants. They have to be accredited programs. The funding flows through those programs to the clinical sites where trainees are located. Those sites have to be Medicaid sites because so much of the funding is Medicaid funding. They have to be currently active Medicaid sites. They have to have active ID numbers and some sort of revenue from the Medicaid program. The original authorizing statute of Merck also made clear that Merck should emphasize primary care or specialties that are in undersupply in Minnesota. Brief history, again. Since 1998, that first distribution, Merck has given out over $450 million to sites around the state. Those are hospitals, clinics, pharmacies. In early years, nursing homes, although they're no longer eligible. As I mentioned, sites have to have Medicaid revenue in order to be eligible. The funds are passed to these training sites through their sponsors. So MDH contracts with sponsoring institutions, which are organizations like the Academic Health Center or the Mayo Clinic or Augsburg, which are organizationally responsible for an accredited program. They have to pass funds through to sites within 60 days and confirm to us that they've done so, but the sites can use the funds in any way that they choose. The statute has no limits on how they choose to use those funds if they are an eligible site. So they can use it to offset general operating expenses. They can use it for supplies and expenses for students or residents. They can use it to offset salaries for the preceptors for those students or residents. That is up to them. I'm going to skip the last bullet now because I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. This table shows you what the 2009 Merck distribution looked like. This is the most recent distribution that was awarded in the fall of last year. With all of the funding sources included, Merck averages somewhere between $50 and $60 million a year in recent years. These are the top 10 sites from the distribution, top 10 out of 600 to 700 sites that are part of the Merck distribution. The largest grant was to HCMC at $8.6 million, and HCMC trains nearly 400 students or residents. A lot of these facilities that have higher numbers of FTEs, the highest percentage of those are usually medical residents or students. The other programs generally have smaller numbers of FTEs. The top 10 facilities have pretty much always been large urban hospitals, despite the way the formula has changed over the years, although which ones make the top two or three can shift a little bit from year to year. The final column on the right is the grant per FTE in 2009. I will be talking more about that on a later slide, but this gives you a good sense of some of the variation in grant per FTE among even some of the larger facilities.
Yeah, please.
What explains the variation for like 93,000 for like Children's in Minneapolis versus 22H for HCMC?
Mm-hmm. Yep, Madam Chair, Ms. Rosenthal. I will talk about that in just a moment. I'm going to give a history of how the formula has changed.
Okay.
It used to be a standard grant per FTE, and a formula change has led to some of those variations. I'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah. Representative Fritz.
Wanted, before you go too far away from this, why are nursing homes no longer eligible? And when did that occur?
Madam Chair, Representative Fritz, I'm not sure I have a great answer for that. It did occur a couple of years ago. I believe originally it was related to whether we could get federal approval to pass funds through to the nursing homes. The language of the statute was changed later to specifically exclude them. I think that also happened in 2007, but I can check on the history of that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I do want to spend a few moments walking through the ways that the formula has changed, which I think will answer the first question that was just asked. As you recall, when Merck was established, its goal was to offset a portion of costs related to clinical training for this set of providers. To reflect that, the formula was based on costs for training at each facility. So for each site, we would collect information about how many FTEs they had, whether they were medical residents, nursing students, PAs, who they were, and how much it cost, the direct and the indirect costs for training in those facilities. We would figure out an average and say, if it costs X amount to train medical residents, we will give every site 5% of that cost for each FTE for medical residents and 5% for nurses. So it was really linked to how much it cost to do that training within each site. Generally, in those early years, Merck was able to reimburse 5 to 10% of the average costs, and it was then a standard amount per FTE. So if you trained medical residents, the grant could have been $10,000 per FTE. For advanced practice nursing students, it could have been $5,000 per FTE, but it was standard across facilities, depending on the size of the pool that we had available. as I mentioned on an earlier slide, we received authority in 2000 to carve funds out of the PMAP program into something that we called the PMAP carve-out pool, and that was distributed separately from Merck for a few years. There was a lot of debate at the time, and always has been, about how to distribute those funds. There were a number of stakeholders who felt that since these were Medicaid dollars, they should be distributed based on Medicaid volume. So if a facility had more Medicaid business, they should receive a larger portion of the funds. So another group of stakeholders that felt that while these were Medicaid dollars, they were Medicaid dollars that were intended to support education. So if a facility had more education, they should get more of the funding, which is how the original Merck formula was set up. One of my first jobs when I came to the health department 10 years ago was to staff a subcommittee that was designed to look at this formula and come to a conclusion. And the conclusion was that we should split the difference and weight the formula equally on Medicaid volume and on costs for training. So that's what we ended up doing with the PMAP carve-out. The two pools were combined in 2004. It probably looks a little strange here to see now we have a two-third cost and one-third MA volume formula, but really that reflected the status quo. When you took the two pots of money and you combined them and you looked at how the formulas worked before, this was the way to hold people harmless when the two pools moved together, was to use this mixed formula that was 67% cost and 33% volume. A couple of other small changes at the time. Some facilities or some programs were concerned about really small grants going to certain sites and that it was an administrative burden for them to pass, you know, a $50 check or $100 check to a number of sites. So for a couple of years, there was the small site cutoff, which eliminated funding for any site that had less than half of an FTE from a program. The popularity of that was mixed. A number of facilities felt that that made it more difficult for them to incent training in small sites because they couldn't. They could still make the choice to pass those funds along, but they intended to do it anyway. The other change that happened during those years was what was known as a discretionary fund. It was an attempt to give facilities a bit more discretion in how they awarded funds. So 90% of the funds available for the program would be distributed based on this 67-33 formula. The other 10% would go to these sponsoring institutions to use as they saw fit. It still had to go to eligible sites and Medicaid sites, but they could decide to provide more funding to one site if they wanted to provide an incentive to take training there. So that gave them a little bit more discretion, and that was in place through 2007.
Dr. Laura.
Madam Chair, could you indicated that under the original formula, it offset 5 to 10% of the actual cost of training.
Mm-hmm.
As the formula has evolved, how much of the cost of training does it actually offset now?
Yes, Madam Chair, Dr. Lohr. That's difficult to say. We no longer collect cost information on a regular basis because it's not part of the formula. So the last time that we collected it was 5 to 6 years ago. In the years when we did, the average cost for a medical resident, which is the most common type of FTE here, was somewhere in the range of $150,000 to $175,000 a year. As you'll see in one of the later slides, depending on the facility, since there's no longer a link to costs, the amount that's reimbursed could be 5% of that or it could be 200% of that or more, because the formula is now based on Medicaid volume rather than on costs. That'll become clearer in a moment, but it really varies by facility now. And that is the most recent change to the formula. This was in 2007 legislative session. The formula switched from this mixed formula that included both costs and volume to a formula that is now based 100% on Medicaid volume, relative volume. So if we have 500 sites that are part of the program, and altogether those 500 sites have $1 billion in Medicaid volume, if site A has 10% of the Medicaid volume across all these sites, they get 10% of the distribution. If they have 20% of the Medicaid volume among the 500, they get 20% of the distribution. So there's not that link any longer to the amount of training or the cost of training. Another change was that the sites that within that 500 or so that have the highest Medicaid volume get a 20% bump on their grant. So that comes from those that are below the line. If you sorted them all in order, in 2009, any facility that had Medicaid volume over $16 or $17 million in that year we were looking at would receive that 20% bonus coming from the others. The change in the statute in 2007 also put in place several direct payments to University of Minnesota Fairview, the Academic Health Center, and the U of M Dental School. The formula change had a fairly significant budgetary impact on a number of facilities, and so there were some payments that were designed to hold certain facilities harmless as a result of that change, or to lessen the impact for them.
Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, so if I'm looking at that right, so there's no longer any link between the number of FTEs or the cost of the training. It's purely based on how much Medicaid business they do.
Yes, Madam Chair and Member Rice, that is correct. And the next few slides we'll talk a little bit more about that as well. So as the member just pointed out, the link with the change in 2007, the link between cost of training or number of trainees and the size of the Merck grant was severed at that point. So if you look in 2000, when the formula was based purely on costs, residents and students who were doing their clinical training at a site somewhere in Hennepin County, anywhere in Hennepin County, those FTEs accounted for 46% of the distribution. And those sites within Hennepin County received 45% of the grant, so very closely tied. Olmsted County received 37% of the grant, despite having 30% of the FTEs, because they had a greater proportion of their trainees were residents, so the cost would be higher, and so they got a little bit more. In 2007, with that mixed formula that looked at both costs and Medicaid volume, again, the pattern is pretty similar. There's a very close match between the percentage of FTEs that are in a county and the percentage of the grant that goes to the county. You start to see a little bit of a shift in some of the counties with that mixed formula. 2009 is the second year in which the new formula was in effect. Again, for Hennepin County, it's not a big difference, 45% of the FTEs and 47% of the grant. Most of the facilities in Hennepin County have both high numbers of trainees and high Medicaid volume. And so both sides of the formula are beneficial in that sense. Ramsey County now receives 21% of the grant but has 11% of the FTEs. Where you see the biggest change is in Olmsted County, which continues to train roughly 33% of the FTEs across these provider types but receives now 6% of the Merck distribution. Another change that happened in the last couple of years was a concentration of the grant in a smaller number of large facilities. You know, the way the grant works, even when it was based on costs, the majority of it went to large hospitals in urban areas because that's where most of the training continues to take place and where most of the costs are incurred. In 2007, that was the last distribution prior to the recent changes, 44% of the grant pool went to the top 10 sites. That rose to 60% in 2008 and 2009, slightly higher concentration in the top 20 sites. I think the other interesting way to look at it, though, is to look at the other end of the distribution. There have always been very small sites in Merck. That was why there was a small site cutoff for a couple of years in the mid-2000s. That's something that has also increased in the last couple of years, primarily because to give a 20% bump to those that have larger volume, you take it from those that are at the smaller end of the distribution. And so it ends up decreasing the grant for those small sites. So 2007, there were no sites that had grants under $50. In 2008, there were 92 of them. There were over 100 sites that had a grant less than $100 in 2008. You know, again, when we did do a small site cutoff years ago, it wasn't based on dollar amount, but it was based on number of trainees. It had mixed effects for the programs that had had asked for it even. I think it had some unanticipated effects for them. But that cutoff was not based on dollar amounts, so it was a little bit more arbitrary. I think in some ways this is the most interesting table. This, again, is from the 2009 distribution. Again, when you look at the original formula, which was tied to costs, and you look at the formula now, the result is that there's a pretty significant difference between between sites in terms of the grants per FTE. So site A, and these are actual numbers from the 2009 distribution. Site A had 0.39 FTEs in this particular year. They had a lot of Medicaid volume, so their grant was nearly $1 million, which translates into $2.4 million per FTE trainee. Site B had about 0.04 FTEs and a grant of $85,000, which translates into $2.2 million per FTE. Site G, on the other hand, down at the bottom, trained nearly 16 FTEs in 2009 and had a grant of $1. So there are obviously some administrative issues there, but this is probably the area where we've received the greatest degree of feedback from the programs that are involved in Merck, not necessarily because of the administrative burden, but because, and here's where I'll refer back to a bullet I skipped earlier, a lot of programs have historically used Merck funds to provide an incentive to sites to take on additional trainees. Currently, if a site is already a training site, they have an advanced practice nursing resident, they get a grant based on their Medicaid volume. If they take on another student, they get the same grant because it's not tied to the number of trainees. And so what programs have told us is that it's more difficult for them to encourage sites to take more trainees or to take trainees from additional programs because the grant doesn't change based on that cost that they're incurring or the number of FTEs that they have. We've heard that from a number of programs, particularly from the pharmacy and the PA programs, where they do have some smaller sites that they're trying to encourage their trainees to go to, and they've found it to be more difficult. Some of their training sites have also told them that they find it a little bit disheartening to receive a very small grant, you know, in return for the work that they have done. So, as I said, we don't often get that feedback about how the grants are actually used at the training site, because they're not required to tell us. So we don't know about the impact on the ground for the training sites, only what the programs have been telling us. And just the final slide, just a couple of thoughts.
If I could just stop you for just a second. Senator Tomasoni.
Can you go back to the other slide? That's the most confusing slide I've ever seen in my life. that grant per FTE thing doesn't mean anything, as far as I can tell, because it just adds confusion to the slide. But why? Why are the numbers so weird like that? Why is Site A getting $1 million for 0.4 of an FTE, and then Site G is getting $1 for why? I mean, why is that happening? I don't know if I heard the why.
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni. The reason for that is that the formula, when we calculate the grant for each site, we don't look at the number of FTEs, the number of trainees that the student has, or the amount it costs to train them. We look just at the amount of Medicaid business that the facility does. And so if Facility 1 has $1 million in Medicaid business.
Did you really send the buck to Site G?
Yes.
You sent the buck?
Yes.
So that cost you about $5 to send it?
It doesn't go directly to the site. All of the grants for individual sites are bundled together, and they go to one of the sponsoring institutions.
Did they cash the check?
To my knowledge, yeah. Yeah, they did. So because the formula looks at Medicaid volume and not at training,
you need to straighten this all out, don't you?
Well, I don't know that it's her job to straighten it out, Senator. I think it might be ours.
It seems strange.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, one thing I should note is that any changes to the Merck formula require a change not only in state law, but require federal approval from CMS. And so we have gotten feedback from a number of the programs about the changes that have happened in the last couple years. But the advisory committee had been somewhat reluctant to change it, to recommend changing it, because they knew that the federal approval process can be difficult. And so they wanted to kind of see what shook out for the next couple years. But it is a two-stage process.
Can we put a name on these sites? Can you put a name on them?
Not off the top of my head, but I mean, it's public information how much has gone to each site. Yes.
But is site A HCMC? I mean, is that?
It would not, Madam Chair, Senator Thomas, site A would not be, it would be a very small site because they only had less than one FTE. So it was most likely a smaller clinic.
But they had a lot of Medicaid.
The one that had a lot of Medicaid volume, yeah.
Senator, if you turn back to page 5, you've got the list for the 2009 Merck distribution, and it has sites and FTEs. Yeah. So you can do a little matchup game there, I think.
Madam Chair, yes, although that's only the top 10 sites, and there are 500. This was I chose these because they're a good cross-section of the grantees in terms of that grant per FTE amount. So.
Okay. Representative Fritz.
Madam Chair, to that point, I'm wondering if a facility like Faribault, who we do a low Medicaid number, because our people go to Hennepin, because you'll see them up there. So it increases the Medicaid volume in those larger hospitals, and it decreases it out in greater Minnesota. Would that be part of this?
Yes, Madam Chair, okay. And Representative Fritz. Yes, the formula looks at volume within one facility, so if patients were coming from another area to a larger facility where they're, you know, able to get a particular type of service, that revenue would be reflected in the larger facility's numbers. This has always been a debate throughout the life of Merck, whether these are funds that should be awarded based on Medicaid volume or based on volume of training. It's been, I would say, a tension in Merck for 15 years.
Dr. Rice?
Madam Chair, looking back, it sounds like one of the stated goals of this program was to support education to promote primary care and needed specialties and other occupations, not just medicine, but areas in primary care or areas in need in the state. And there are other areas other than just primary care that need in the state. If that's the case, under the current formula, I don't see how that happens, really, because a site can choose to bring in a quarter-time person and get a huge fund that has no relationship to what they're training for, correct?
Madam Chair, Dr. Rice, yes, that is correct. I think another important thing to note is, as I mentioned, formula changes require CMS approval. CMS had in previous years indicated a fairly strong preference for a formula that awards based on Medicaid volume. It's unclear where CMS would stand on that issue now, and whether they would be open to a formula that is more closely linked to other workforce goals. You know, we're in a different environment now, nationally and in the state, than we were when the more recent changes were made and as the formula has morphed over the years. So,
okay. Dr. Baird, and then we're going to, then I have a quick comment, and we should probably wrap this up.
Actually,
go ahead, Dr. Baird.
I could wait until her final comments, Madam Chair. Oh. I think she's addressing some good questions.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll wait till after that.
Okay.
Well, and the last slide, I think we've already somewhat covered it. As a couple of the members have noted, Merck has been neutral in giving greater weight to certain types of providers over others or certain geographic areas over others. And I think there are valid policy questions as to whether Merck can or should or is the right mechanism to incent training of certain types of providers, primary care or others, to promote care, coordinated care in medical homes, to promote training in ambulatory sites, to reward programs that keep a greater percentage of their graduates in Minnesota, to incent training that covers certain types of content around coordination of care or safety or quality. Those are not things that have been part of the formula in the past, and as I noted in response to the previous question, it's unclear what the well, we know what the process would be for getting federal approval. It's unclear whether that approval would be obtained, depending on any changes that might happen to Merck. But I think they are questions for, certainly for the state to consider.
Thank you very much. Dr. Baird, sorry.
Well, first of all, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I've been around Merck for a long time and never seen quite such a clear explanation, so thank you for that. About 15 years ago, I used to be in New York State, and there was a council on graduate medical education there that addressed exactly those questions. And during the time I was there, doubled the uptick for primary care and preventive medicine, and nowadays might have said general surgery or nursing or anything. But they did use those Medicaid funds related to education specifically to drive workforce. And it's done in Utah as well. And I think it's had at least some effect. It's never easy. And so that's one question. The second thing is yesterday, the state of Minnesota was named as one of 8 states to have a Medicare, Medicaid pilot on healthcare homes. And I don't know, in fact, how that's going to play out. It'll take a number of months for somebody to figure it out. But we're many of us involved indirectly in that. This could be a link if they're developing healthcare homes, or even if we relink this to anything to do with interdisciplinary education, we would at least be lining up in the same direction as the pilots, and we are one of only 8 states doing that. So I hope that Merck looks at that new federal support for healthcare homes and tries to answer some of the very good questions you listed there in your last slide.
Thank you. Ms. Rosenthal.
You may have addressed this before, but it might bear repeating. Is the current state budget crisis going to have any impact on Merck funding and funds that you're going to be able to disperse over the next couple of years?
Madam Chair, Ms. Rosenthal, we are getting ready to distribute the next round of funding sometime between now and the end of the year, in the $50 million range. And there are no concerns about that distribution of funds. I don't know if any of us can predict what will happen in the coming session. I think that Merck funds, the PMAP carve-out in particular, you know, it is a significant chunk of Medicaid funding, and it seems that there's certainly a possibility that that or any other funding could be at risk at some point during this process.
And then I have a question also, which is in what ways, if any, does the Accountable Care Act impact Merck? I mean, is there any, you know, specific ways that it's going to impact this?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't believe so. I don't believe there are many provisions that are specific to graduate medical education. I know that there have been a lot of organizations that have come out with policy positions around needed reforms to graduate medical education in light of health reform and in light of sort of the move towards looking at preventive care and looking at coordinated care. I do not know very many provisions specifically in the Accountable Care Act, though.
Okay, thank you. Did I see another hand around here? Okay. Well, that was indeed, I agree, that was a very, very good presentation, and I've been hearing about Merck for a number of years and involved with a little of this and never understood it nearly as well as I think I do now. So thank you very, very much for your presentation.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me.
So we will move on here and go to Michelle Kimball, who's going to talk with us a little bit about long-term care issues that we haven't really dealt with specifically very much in this work group yet. And thank you very much for coming. Welcome.
And I'm sure.
Go ahead, if you would introduce yourself.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. I am Michelle Kimball. I'm the Senior State Director of AARP here in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today about the anticipated workforce shortage in our current long-term care system. As our population is aging, this is a very significant and timely topic, and we are very pleased to be able to contribute to that discussion today. As a member of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition, AARP has been diligently working with a coalition of representatives of professional caregivers, elders, and their families to improve quality and to find solutions to the long-term care workforce shortage in Minnesota specifically. The mission of this coalition captures this effort succinctly: to improve the quality of long-term care for those who depend on it and those who provide it. The long-range goal is to build a stable, committed, rewarded, and well-trained workforce to meet the need, the growing need for direct caregivers in residential and community settings. Success will be marked as older Minnesotans have improved access to the quality long-term care services they need, and workers can count on caregiving careers to support their families. We know that the demographics of our state are changing. Our population is aging, and so is our workforce. Experts project a decrease in the number of younger workers over the next 20 years. We also know that Minnesotans prefer to receive care in their homes and communities. And as such, there is a growing shift away from more traditional nursing home care toward home and community-based care. The combination of these factors will put a particular strain on the long-term care industry in both institutional settings as well as in family homes. Now, a recent report to the Minnesota Legislature by the Minnesota Department of Human Services entitled Status of Long-Term Care in Minnesota 2010 outlined the statistics. So let me read them for you. In Minnesota, between now and 2020, the population of those over the age of 65 is expected to increase by 40%, while those under the age of 65 will increase by only 4%. Minnesota ranks second among states in life expectancy at birth, second only to Hawaii, I might add, 78.82 years. And add to that a net increase in those over the age of 85 who are returning back to Minnesota after spending their younger retirement years in other states, and you have an increasing number of what we call the oldest old. And many of those will eventually need some form of long-term care.
Could I just ask a question? I'm sorry.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
You know, we usually hear the opposite. We hear that people are fleeing Minnesota because of lower taxes in other places. So you're saying that the elderly are coming back? The very old are coming back?
The very old are coming back because as...
To enjoy the winter here?
Madam Chair, actually because of family. And they are finding that it is much more difficult in their later years to be farther away from family, especially as they become frailer.
Okay, so it's not our generous welfare benefits or anything like that, huh?
No, it
okay.
is not.
Just wanted to make sure. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Over two-thirds of those age 85 and older, which I have just described, actually have at least one disability. And, in fact, are more likely to have multiple disabilities, which can often create barriers to living independently. And that, Madam Chair, is the biggest reason why many are moving back closer to family. Of perhaps the greatest significance in this forecast by our state demographer is of an older workforce with expectations of employer-sponsored benefits and a growing competition for fewer younger workers. As we all know, the long-term care system in Minnesota and indeed throughout the country depends on low-wage workers and, as such, suffers from a very high turnover rate. Studies by the Alzheimer's Association have found that high turnover among long-term care staff creates enormous costs for providers, residents, and workers. Providers spend from $1,400 to $4,300 for each worker they have to replace, an amount that can exceed four times the monthly salary they actually pay that worker. The cost of temporary workers is estimated at 200% of that for a regular employee, and the quality of care for residents suffers from high turnover. Residents lose the continuity of care from familiar workers who know them and understand their needs, and this is a loss that is actually particularly acute among dementia patients. Workers who actually remain face frustration, added stress, injury, and often accidents. One might well ask not why so many workers leave long-term care, but rather why so many actually stay. Studies show that they stay because they love the work and the people for whom they care, but we are making it increasingly difficult for workers to make that decision to actually stay. The report that I talked about earlier by the Minnesota Department of Human Services says it best, and I will quote directly. The labor force growth in Minnesota will decrease by two-thirds in the upcoming decade. Competition for new workers will put new demands on Minnesota's long-term care industry, already coping with low wages. In light of the continued trends, including the growth in demand for long-term care services and the aging of the general and workforce populations, the expansion and development of the direct care workforce is at risk of not keeping pace with the need for additional staff in the field of long-term care, including home and community-based care. So, should we anticipate the need for new workers from the standpoint of both the aging workforce and the increasing shift to home-delivered care? Absolutely, but we also must address the growing strain in our long-term care facilities. The problem isn't just in keeping our current workforce, but in actually attracting a future workforce. And unfortunately, whether it is home and community-based care or in a more traditional nursing home setting, there exists many disincentives for attracting the long-term care workers we desperately need. These disincentives include, first and foremost, relatively low wages, and in many cases, minimum to just above minimum wage. Heavy physical labor is also an issue. There are emotional demands of such direct care. There are low staffing levels, which result in high workloads for those who stay, and sometimes even dangerous working conditions. There's also inadequate career paths, and there is a lack of health insurance for direct care workers and their families. AARP believes that it is very important to improve these factors and to create incentives, financial and otherwise, in the system to, first, adequately compensate these low-wage workers. We also feel it's exceptionally important to provide effective training and increase staffing levels to ensure quality care and worker safety. We believe there should be a creation of career paths to reduce the high turnover rate, and there should be adequate and accessible and affordable health care coverage. This last point has been identified by many experts as perhaps actually the greatest barrier to retaining quality long-term care workers. One solution is the recently passed National Health Care Reform Law and the expectation that an affordable health insurance exchange will be established and available by 2014 for these long-term care workers, regardless of what their income is, to buy into. This, however, is still in the implementation phase, not expected to be implemented for the next 4 years, as I just indicated. So it will be essential and important to ensure that this aspect of healthcare reform continues to move forward and is successfully implemented. I would also like to note that there is currently a lot of work actually being done on job training, on career paths, dislocated workers, and homemaker retraining. Much of this, however, is being done by a variety of different public entities, such as the Department of Employment and Economic Development and MNSCU, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. AARP would actually like to suggest that the workforce group may want to draw a roadmap of what action is being taken by these entities, and if the map shows relatively disjointed efforts, perhaps some interagency coordination legislation should be enacted during the upcoming legislative session. Now, up until now, I have been focused on the general long-term care worker, and I would like to take a moment to focus on a very specialized group of long-term care workers whose highly educated skills are a critical part of keeping our elders healthy and safe. They literally save lives, and they work to improve patient outcomes every day. These are our nurses. I would like you to know that Americans treated in hospitals that don't have enough nurses experience more complications, such as infections and longer hospital stays. This translates to nursing facilities as well. Nurses prevent medical errors and improve patient safety and help patients and families safely manage their medication. On the national level, AARP has been looking for solutions to the growing workforce shortage of nurses through our Center to Champion Nursing in America, along with the AARP Foundation and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The center, which is a consumer-driven national force for change, works to increase the nation's capacity to educate and retain nurses who are prepared and empowered to positively impact healthcare access, quality, and costs. Like other sectors of the workforce, the severe downturn in the economy has affected the supply of and the demand for nurses. Many nurses who had actually planned to retire are staying in their jobs. mostly because there aren't new and younger workers to replace them. And part-time nurses are seeking more hours. Non-working nurses with spouses who have lost jobs are also returning to work. These trends have filled slots for nurses left previously vacant, and in a few states, some recent nursing school graduates are actually having difficulty finding jobs. Yet in rural, underserved areas, there exists a very significant and real need for nurses. Various surveys report that over half of today's employed nurses plan to retire in the next 15 to 20 years. So this is just at a time when the demand for nursing care will reach an all-time high. As a result, it will be important to begin planning right now to provide the incentives to encourage more young people to choose nursing as a career, and in particular, as a career in the long-term care side of our healthcare system. Finally, I would be remiss if I did not address the biggest issue facing all of the concerns that I have just outlined in my testimony, and this issue is the lack of adequate, targeted reimbursement for long-term care providers, which results in lower wages for staff, a lack of health insurance, and therefore an inability to retain quality staff that can provide the highest quality care. Given the state's ongoing fiscal crisis, there is an urgent need to address long-term care funding, both public and private, and to reform the system. This will not be done overnight, so it will be important to, at a minimum, maintain the current level of funding currently in the system. Any further reductions will result in reductions in workforce and thus a reduction in quality, and just at a time when the need for long-term care is actually growing. On behalf of the nearly 700,000 members of AARP statewide, I want to thank you for this opportunity to provide feedback, and I am very happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the group? Senator Tomasoni.
When you talked about nurses in the workforce, were you talking about nurses in the workforce related to long-term care only or nurses in general?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I was talking about nurses in general, but in particular it does impact even more strongly the long-term care system. Nurses do tend to choose careers in the acute care side of our healthcare system before choosing those in the long-term care side of the system, mostly because of pay.
Well, we had this discussion a couple weeks ago about nurses again, and we keep hearing there's a shortage, and I keep getting phone calls that nurses can't get jobs. So when you said 10 to 15 years, it seems to me that if we're going to get people to go into, I mean, if I were graduating from high school and wanted to go to become a nurse and found out I couldn't get a job for 10 to 15 years, I don't know that I would go into that particular job, and I'm thinking that, boy, it seems to me now, and maybe you guys can all correct me here if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that we've been encouraging our colleges to educate nurses for at least 5 years now, if not longer, but I'm still hearing there's a shortage, I don't know. I mean, I think that's part of our charge here is to kind of figure that out if there is or not. And the fact that people are going to retire is something very important to consider. But if we're over training people and people aren't getting jobs, I'm not sure that that's a good idea either. So I know we're having the same problem with electricians, for example, that the colleges are training the electricians, but we got 50% of the electricians on the bench and they aren't working. And so these kids are coming out of college and they're electricians and they can't get a job. And I'm afraid that we're going to create the same issue here. And I don't know, but I mean, because every time somebody testifies in front of us, they say we need nurses. And then and you guys got to chime in here now.
Yeah, a bunch of our committee members here want to respond.
Because I don't want to send them to Texas.
I think Dr. Rice is first. So why don't we go this way, we'll work up the table.
Madam Chair. I think in the rural settings, there is continued often to be a shortage. I think sometimes it is more, it's a matter of it's distribution more than shortage sometimes. I also know I've been around long enough now, nursing is one of those occupations, as there are others too, that we seem to go in these waves of there's not enough, so we train a bunch, and then there's too many, so nobody goes into it, and then there's not enough. And so it gets this cycle, I don't know how you stabilize that, but the problem is there is a little bit of lag time in terms of the training period, and I think I've seen a certain amount of that where it seems like there's too many around, and then nobody goes into it. But then by the time everybody sees the shortage, it drops out. And I think, as it was outlined here, I think there are some trends coming up. I think there is some difficulty finding jobs to some extent because of people delaying dropping out because of current finances and the current economy. And that's kind of thrown off some of those predictions. So I think there's a little bit of a hesitation here. But I would be hesitant to – I don't know all the numbers in detail, but I would be hesitant to say we need to pull back lots from it, because I do see that there's a trend coming where we're going to need more. We certainly need more out in rural settings now. And I think to some extent, if you pull back too far, I think it's almost we're going to get a mass of them kind of going more later. And that's kind of true in primary care too. But.
Okay, Mr. Rosenthal.
Yeah, so this is just anecdotally from one of our major employers. We have a tuition reimbursement fund as well as extra money that pays for our members to go back to school, and we're very interested, and the employer is very interested in making sure that they stay within the system. And in a conversation just 2 weeks ago, we learned that there are 400 graduates, licensed RNs, who are working as nursing assistants or have had to leave the system and are now working in long-term care. But are not working as nurses within this facility, are keeping their foot in the door by, you know, sort of going casual. They are anticipating that maybe in 3 years they may need 700 nurses, but that depends on the economy getting back to normal. And I don't know a single national economist who can guarantee that we're going to be getting back to normal in 3 years. So I do think this is one anecdote, but it is a very major employer. And I think that where my concern is with long-term care is that these 275 nurses who are working in long-term care, the minute the major acute care hospitals start hiring, all of them are going to be leaving long-term care, and then who is going to be filling in the long-term care facilities? On the other hand, you balance that against, you know, our members who are incurring, you know, $20,000 worth of debt and trying to figure out how they're going to pay it off, you know, making, you know, the salary of a nursing assistant rather than the salary of a nurse. And so I think there's some incredible irresponsibility, because that is not handled by an institution. That debt is handled by an individual who is trying to figure out, A, how do I pay it off? Where do I get a job? And how do I hone my skills so that I can actually become a nurse at some point? And if we can't figure out how to get a better handle on these numbers so that we don't have these, you know, we heard from Jane Foote from Health Force, who dealt with this problem of clinicals and trying to figure out how to match clinical placements to, you know, to make it sort of less, you know, sort of chaotic. It seems to me that, you know, with the expertise, we ought to be able to figure out how to make this less chaotic. And so that it really works for the advantage of the system, for delivering health, and for the individual who's studying.
Right. Well, it strikes me that this is, I kind of a little bit flippantly want to say this is capitalism. You know, it's kind of like it's somewhat inherent in our system, I think, because you have all these different players and no overarching planning authority. But I hear you. But I just also wanted to say that the economy will pick up, but also, you know, with the Accountable Care Act and with the expansion of coverage for many, many, many people are going to have access to health care, assuming that we can give them access by having enough workers there to give them access. So there will be more demand, which I have to assume will drive the employment of nurses. So even though right now we do obviously have a problem with people getting jobs, I can't help but think that that's the shorter-term problem, and the longer-term problem is going to be the shortage of people to fill those roles. Ms. Chesney.
I think one of the things to bear in mind, though, is as hospitals tend to plan and they look for what they would typically think is the rate of turnover based on the age of their nursing group, I think if you were to talk to many hospitals, they would tell you that when the bottom fell out of the economy 2 years ago, there was just an enormous shift in many people choosing to stay in that really were anticipated to be on track to retire or to leave the workforce, and then suddenly found themselves not able to. Retirement portfolios were like the rest of ours. But I think there were some tremendous shifts there. I can also tell you that in 2007 and even in 2008, a majority of our, like at the university, a majority of our baccalaureate students were placed, had jobs prior to graduation. When I say a majority, like 80, 85% of them prior to graduation already had jobs locked down. Again, completely reversed, you know, over the last 2 years, so that we're lucky if 25, 30% of them right now have a job locked down by graduation, although our numbers tend to keep increasing then as time goes on. And I think, you know, what we're hearing from hospitals, too, people are aware of the staffing issues within hospitals and just this whole reduction of people losing insurance and inability to pay copays and what have you, that I think most hospitals would also say that their elective surgery rates are tremendously down from what they would typically be. So I agree, as people have access to care, I think, you know, we could see, and as the economy gets better, we could see a reversal of this in a very short term in terms of then suddenly finding ourselves again in the need area. And then I would also agree very much with Dr. Rice's comments that in rural areas, we know there are shortages now. The other piece to keep in mind is we do have to look, and I think it warrants some study, looking at distribution. Because as we look at distribution of where nurses are going, our faculty, 65% of our faculty at the University of Minnesota in nursing will retire within the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. We do not have 65% graduates coming in who are going to be a doctor of nursing practice or PhD prepared to fill that void. We also know with the shortage in primary care physicians projected by 2020, that even if we could fill every one of our advanced practice programs now in the state, we likely won't have enough to still fill the gap mm-hmm. of what we will need in the coming, 10 years. So I think part of it is looking at how can we take the workforce and take the two-year grads and give and have more access to bridging programs within the state so they can get a baccalaureate, and how can we move people on into some of those levels where we need advanced practice and we need faculty. So some of it's a distribution issue. A lot of it's based on a number of factors in the economy. But I think all of us at the university, as we plan and look and go to conferences around the nation, we are very concerned about a serious shortage within the next 10 years. So it's just one of those aberrations right now, but I don't see that lasting, and I think we clearly have a need to move people in the education sphere in nursing considerably down the road so that we can meet needs.
Well, Madam Chair, you said something pretty interesting in that you were placing 85% of the nurses before they even graduated before 2008, and I'm just wondering if we filled the holes that were there. And that with a combination of people not retiring has resulted in the new people not being able to find jobs, and maybe we're training way too many right now for what's out there, but we certainly seem to need them in the very near future. Yeah. It's a hard problem to solve, I think, but I know that we definitely talked about the nursing shortage for at least 5 or 6 years, and I'm just wondering if we got somewhere with that. That statistic about 85% of the people being placed before they got out of college.
And I think Representative Fritz wanted to speak. I just wanted to say, Ms. Rosenthal, I certainly didn't mean to minimize what you were saying. You know, it just kind of occurred to me that it's a problem in our system that we have that and that lack of coordination. And I think you're absolutely right that we need to think of some models and some ways to do better, because the individuals certainly get caught in that. And, you know, people go out, they try to get an education, they do what we want them to do, and then they get stuck somehow. So, you're absolutely right, and I didn't mean to minimize what you were saying. I think it's a very good point. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Senator, to your point of hearing, and I also sit on the healthcare committees and do hear the nursing shortage over and over again, but I do want to take it down to the grassroots, and I'm talking about, and I want to thank Michelle for coming today from AARP, because this is about the direct care worker, and those are the people that are coming to us as well. Those are the nursing assistants and the licensed practical nurse like myself for the last 40 years. This is nothing new. In rural Minnesota, the rates that we get in reimbursement are lower, have been lower for 40 years. I get paid much less than the LPN in a nursing home up in this district. That has never changed. We've addressed it, and we've brought legislation forward trying to increase the rates, but never have. And so we all then fail when to feed the system from the ground up. We have nursing assistants who are working in these nursing homes who are oftentimes low-level entry, not even having a high school diploma. So we need to help them through the scholarship program that we did have in place. We need to fix that, put it back, and heighten it, enlighten it, and give that to people so that people of poor means are able to afford to become an LPN, an RN, and then perhaps even, you know, a doctor. God, you know, forbid that someone, you know, could actually do that. But we need to address that at the local grassroots level. And I looking at I've lived this. And we do know that people age 85 are presenting in the nursing home with 5, 6, 7 disabilities, the end stage of cancer, the end stage of heart, the end stage of stroke. They cannot be cared for adequately in their daughter's home. The daughter is probably trying to work at the nursing home. So that's the reality. The reality is that exists is that there is a workforce out there looking for help, but they need better than $8.36 an hour. And that's what they're getting in the assisted living facility. A 23-year-old young man that I just spoke to, trying to go to college, wants to be an RN, can't afford it because he's working in the assisted living facility for $8.36 an hour. That is what is really happening, and that prevents us from getting nurse educators. You have to start at the beginning and have to reimburse adequately. And thank you, Michelle, for bringing this again to the table. And I hope that in the future we can continue to actually fix some of these things.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. So we've got Dr. Rice and Ms. Chesney, and then I think we probably need to move on. So please.
Madam Chair, just a quick response to that. I worked as an orderly for a year before I got into my master's work and then subsequent medical school. I think I got $6 an hour back in 84. So it hasn't gone very far, over that time. It's a good point. Back to the long-term care issue and kind of commentary on that. There is a real issue over the funding because it is very difficult to provide good quality care in the nursing homes and not just make money, but actually just to stay afloat. Mm-hmm. Our community hospital recently sold its nursing home because they could not make things work, sold it to a private entity who's making it work by basically ratcheting everything down incredibly, and which is suffering. We're losing a lot of long-term dedicated staff, which is often typical in small nursing homes in the rural setting. And it's creating a lot of turnover, which creates a lot of the other costs and issues. I don't know that there's any way to beef up the finances for that currently, but one of the things that drives the difficulty is the interminable number of regulations and policies and things that are put in place in terms of what the homes are held to. And I am very much a person in favor of guidelines and standards and making sure things are done safe, but it's reached a place of ridiculousness in the nursing homes, in my opinion. And it's to the point where I see most of the nurses spending much more time trying to justify what they've done than actually taking care of the mm-hmm. patients. Mm-hmm. And it has reached a point that is really difficult to sustain. An anecdote from my own personal experience in the nursing home at Bedette, where I used to practice, the regulators that come through every year, they basically seem to have to find something each year to ding you on.
That wasn't the Duluth team.
I don't know who does it up there. I think it's the northwest corner.
They're bad in Duluth, I know that.
It was a small nursing home that had two rooms that shared a bathroom at a time. And the first year they came through, they cited them and gave them a complaint because they had the commodes in the bathrooms. And they said that's not good because it gets in the way and it's a problem for patients getting out of the bathroom when they need to, which it is. And so they said, well, there's not a lot of room in the rooms. Where do you want them put? I said, well, you should put by the bedside because that's where the patients would actually need them. So the next year they came around and they got cited because they're keeping the commodes at the bedside because, well, that's like putting your bathroom in your living room. You can't do that. So he says, well, that's fine. We don't have a lot of places. Where do you want us to put it? Well, you should put it in the closet.
So next year they came around and says, what are you doing putting these dirty commodes in people's closets with their clean clothes? And says, well, where do you want them kept? We put them in the bathroom, of course. That's where they ought to be. And these are the kinds of things we see. It's like there's this constant need for the regulators to come through and cite something, to have them doing something. Then they've got to justify that. They've got to come around. They've got to set new policy. They've got to set new places to do things. It's a problem in many areas of medicine, but the nursing homes, to me, have almost gotten to an extreme level of that.
Yeah,
and it's costing a lot in order to do that because it takes up a lot of time away from actual patient care.
Yeah, Dr. Rice, thank you for that. You know, this is something that, you know, it's certainly not the first I've heard about it. I think, though, it's a topic that we could go off on for a long time here, and I appreciate you bringing that up. I think we're getting a little outside the scope of our work here, though. And so if it's okay, you know, and I realize that it all relates to workforce in that, you know, the more busy work you do, the less patient care you do. I think that's a very good point. But I think right now it's a little bit outside the scope of at least what we're going to be able to manage here in terms of our report and so on. And I know Ms. Chesney was next, and then I'll go to Dr. Baird.
Just a side comment. A number of programs in the state of Minnesota, a number of nursing programs, are putting into place programs that really emphasize care of elders, at the baccalaureate level and certainly at the graduate level. And I think one of the things that our goal is that we'd like to see a day where it's not the absolute least desirable place to work. Mm-hmm. And I think as all of us consider where we are in the aging spectrum, we may also want to see that day come as well. But I think in terms of, really trying to bring to bear special needs of elders, trying to really make this a specialty area in nursing, but of course to attract people, it goes back to what you referred to as well, and that is that we have to pay people for the care that they're giving, and I think that that is absolutely a discouraging factor. But I do think nursing programs across the country, but certainly in the state, we're very much trying to expose students more to really look at what we would consider high-quality, creative nursing within geriatric facilities and really try to raise the respect that type of nursing deserves and what our elders deserve. So,
mm-hmm. Thank you. Dr. Baird?
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, first of all, again, thank you for your presentation, Michelle. I think this was, again, bringing a tough topic to the focus for this committee. And regarding workforce, we do need all the players we can get, nurses, physicians, and others, but there's both good news and bad news for physician training. The good news is that a couple years ago, we helped establish a palliative care fellowship without state support, and it's growing and it's extended to the VA and now Children's Hospital, and I think that's going to develop a tiny little ledge to stand on for workforce in these difficult areas that actually include things like aging. But we are not succeeding in training geriatricians. We can get people to go into sports medicine, all kinds of things in that direction. We get them into palliative care and cancer. But for physicians training, I can count on one hand the number of graduates out of all 1,000 graduates out of the University of Minnesota graduate training programs. Probably at Mayo it's similar. You can count on this hand the number that ever anywhere in the country then go to a fellowship in geriatrics out of hundreds or maybe 1,000 graduates, partly because they can't make a living doing that, but also there isn't a training program. That we used to have one that collapsed when state funding collapsed about 8 years ago. We used to have a nationally recognized geriatric center that literally collapsed. So there is a workforce for nurses and others, and yet on the physician end, there is zero going on, or nearly zero at the moment. And yet if we could find an avenue for that, along with nursing faculty, what that really trains is the point of the spear to help put really leaders into these roles to help develop others to help fill the workforce needs. But you need that top end, whether faculty in nursing or medicine. And we have lost ground from a decade ago.
Okay. I'm going to call on Representative Fritz, but we're going to need to move on if we're going to finish up the rest of our agenda. So thank you very much, Ms. Kimball.
Thank you.
You need her there for
no,
your question.
I really wanted to emphasize was, Madam Chairman, that in your recommendations for the draft that you're going to be putting together, that you highly consider the reimbursement rate of the nursing homes in the state of Minnesota, especially out in greater Minnesota, because nothing yet has been done in that area to bring that rate up to at least what our folks are getting in the urban area.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. And, of course, you and I have both worked on that issue. And, you know, this whole thing about the on-the-ground workforce is so important. You know, we're talking about geriatricians, and, you know, that's a big issue, too. But, you know, we've got to have, obviously, the workforce at all levels, because we can have wonderful diagnosis and treatment and nobody to provide the care. And then it's pretty useless to have the wonderful diagnosis and treatment. So, it just makes me really wish that we had more time. And, of course, funding is something that, you and I know that it's going to be very, very difficult. So, okay, well, thank you all for that. Very good, very interesting discussion. So I think what we want to do now in the last 40 minutes that we have today is go back to the recommendations that we had been given. And actually, before I do that, I want to direct everybody's attention to the letter here that our physician members wrote for us, if I can find my copy of it. Paper and always the wrong ones. Thank you. So I think this letter, I hope you all have it. Does everybody have it? Okay. And if you've had a chance to look at it, and I just think, first of all, I appreciate receiving this, and I think it does, help us to kind of remember the context that I think we'd like to work in here. And we've had in our list here a number of very good and thoughtful recommendations, which we very much appreciate. And obviously, we have to whittle this down some and figure out how to frame it in terms of our report, which is not to say that any of these are not valuable or important or couldn't be implemented at some time. But we are going to have to make some choices, especially in how we frame our reports. So, I think that we had talked at one time, as the letter points out, about thinking in terms of teams. And I don't know how that really relates to the nursing home workers that we were just speaking of, but except perhaps that, obviously they work in teams as well, and I don't know that we have time to really talk about those teams and how we might support those teams. But I just would like us to, as we talk about the rest of these, we can maybe keep in mind the principles that are raised in the letter, unless anybody has anything to discuss about the letter itself or points that are being made here. Dr. Lohr?
Just the main thing that we wanted to convey and make sure that we were reflecting on is that as we move forward towards the whatever we cover in the report or how it comes out, that we're going to create an infrastructure and a system so that there are teams working together, and that we're going to facilitate the communication between the team members and make sure that every member of the team is really working at the highest level they can, but for the team and really for the patients. I mean, that's why we're doing this. It's for patients. It's not for nurses or doctors or psychiatrists. It's for patients. And if we can create that sort of an infrastructure so that we can really work together as a team, and that would include, if you look at the spectrum of care from someone is born, they live their life, eventually they, require palliative care and they die, that includes nursing homes and end-of-life sorts of care. And that's really what we wanted to try to convey and make sure that we're thinking in those terms. Some of the discussions have gotten fairly parochial, and we all come with our own interests, and that's why this is such a good group. But we need to be thinking really at the broader picture and focusing on how we best provide care for every Minnesotan across the span of their life.
Okay, thank you. Your comments on that, Dr. Baird?
Madam Chair, I think we heard a good discussion today, for example, about one of the longstanding support systems for all kinds of professional education called MERC. And to the degree, for unusual reasons, it had to be functionally disconnected from education. I know that was a difficult era, but that's what happened. And we're now seeing it play out so that it is supporting some good things, which is care, but it's completely divorced, except by accident, from education. So if there were any recommendation to support the team effort, we have a potential funding source that still exists. And if it could be rededicated to its original purpose, because it is already multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, that single effort probably would be championed and welcomed all over the state. And it still would support care, but it would link it back to education for this next generation of workforce that we all say we need, and I think we do.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think it's a very good point. I think that was, although we didn't talk about it when we heard the MERC presentation, I think we were all kind of struck by the same thing of how disconnected it is from the actual educational pieces. And, I think that you make a very good point. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, on that, on the discussion of MERC, I wonder, I think it might be helpful to ask David Godfrey from Hennepin County Medical Center to come up, and I think he'd like to make a few comments or share some thoughts with us.
Okay. Representative Senator Lynch, that's fine. If you could just be real brief, though, because we do have a lot of other things to get to, and I wasn't expecting that presentation, but please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, I just wanted to step up and, from our perspective, clarify a few things that have been said about the MERC formula and MERC history. And I think it's important to note that the MERC payment is actually an enhanced Medicaid payment to cover the costs associated with medical education for the care of the Medicaid population. And CMS has had that position since 2006, and in fact came to the state and said, you are basing your Medicaid payment on other things than Medicaid volume, and told the state that that was not acceptable. MDH brought forth a revised formula which recognized CMS's concerns. And I think it's a bit speculative to believe that CMS would now fall back and change its position 3 years, 4 years later. We do have a new administration, but this is still a Medicaid payment to cover the cost of medical education for Medicaid services. And introducing certain things like FTEs and actual just costs, I think, goes against the principle that they've put forth for the last number of years. And finally, I would say it would be possible to use MERC funds to direct that are the state share of MERC funds and direct those to hospitals or other providers based on education costs. But you would not be able to get, in my opinion, the federal share for that, and therefore you're actually shrinking, potentially, the amount of money available for medical education in the state by redirecting those funds based on something other than Medicaid volume. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, thanks. Well, I guess the question of whether we could get waivers or what CMS would do is kind of an empirical question, I guess, unless we ask them, I guess we won't know. So, I think, too, it's sort of striking to me that we need to think, if we're talking about workforce, it's sort of like present day right now money for care, which we all know is very short. We're all, kind of fighting for every dollar to support medical care right now. But then when we talk about workforce, we're talking about care, too, just not care today. It's care today or care tomorrow. So, some things for us to think about. But anyway, I want to turn to the sheet, and you should all have for our spreadsheet, and it's been revised and updated with some of our comments that reflect some of our conversations so far. And before we turn to this, I just want to say that when I looked at this on the side that has the number one and number three, it says delete. And when I saw that, I said, no, we're not deleting anything. We're certainly not deleting those. So I want to, quick, before anybody takes that too seriously, I want to correct it. I would write defer, not delete, because, we did decide that, perhaps those weren't things we could do much about right now, but we're certainly not deleting them. So Let's see, we had a couple of things here that we had put hold until the Merck presentation, and I wonder if anybody, Mr. Taubenheim isn't able to be here today, so, you know, number five, Laura, did you want to discuss that a little bit?
My understanding is similar to what was just said by the person at Hennepin County, that if we change the Merck formula, we're going to lose federal funds, that it's beyond our state's control. Because I had done my research at Fairview and talked to the people that handle this as well, and they said you've got to be really careful with that because, you know, for us, we deal with a lot of medical assistance patients. And we also, if you saw the volume of the providers that we're training, and if we lose that match, many of us will be even disadvantaged more, and there'll be a smaller pot of money. So I guess, you know, the concern I just heard was similar to what I've heard when I brought this conversation back. I think we need to protect what we have and if there's a way to get more, but I don't know if changing the formula, it sounds like we're going to get less unless it changes nationally.
Okay, I'm going to go to Dr. Rice and then Ms. Stark and then Ms. Rosenthal.
Madam Chair, I think, you know, if we tried to propose a change, that means we're going to get less money to spread around. I don't think that makes sense. But it seems to me that we ought to be able to try and look at the formula and see if there's something we can come up with to try and look for a waiver or some other way to approach it. I think you can base it on Medicare populations, but also have some sort of factor between, because I can't imagine the federal government doesn't want to make sure people are being trained for the right things. I mean, if somebody's getting a $1 million grant to put out a neurologically, orthopedically associated PA quarter-time equivalent a year, I'm not sure that's a good use of the funds. I think you want to make sure you're gearing it towards what's really needed. So I think if you, rather than just simply a proportional amount, say so much of it goes for this and this, to develop a formula that has some sort of factoring that gears things. Because my experience at the U, and Max there now could probably add to this as to whether it's still true or not, but there was not necessarily a friendly environment for primary care when I went through, and I think there's still a certain amount of that. I think it's better probably than it was due to people like Mac. But I think there's traditionally in the academic centers, there's not always the same recognition of what's needed across the state. There's a higher value sometimes on research, on the real kind of flashy specialties and other things, and it can actually have a negative impact. Whereas if the funds steer things towards a positive impact, you know, it's kind of like back in the 70s, you know, they set up the RPAP funds that really structured that program and drove it. And that did a lot for developing a lot of family medicine and other primary care in the state, because there were dedicated funds that the university couldn't siphon off and make do somewhere else. The same way, if you got funds that are targeted to certain performance standards, it will help guide those standards, and I think can still be tied to the Medicaid population.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Stark, and then Ms. Rosenthal, and then Dr. Beard.
Madam Chair, just echoing what Dr. Rice said, to not change the formula but direct the funds to, like, integrated care, primary care, those kinds of things.
You mean at the sites that are currently getting the funds?
Right.
Ms. Rosenthal.
No, I mean, it just seems to me that we are working within a universe of diminishing amounts of money to try to incentivize, you know, the production of you know, healthcare professionals. And I do not want to mess with Medicaid money as a taxpayer. I like the idea of that money going to hospitals and other places that are treating, you know, Medicaid, you know, recipients. I think that makes sense to me. But I think that if we're taking a look at how healthcare delivery is going to change over the next 10 or 15 years, moving from acute care into ambulatory care, into management of chronic problems, you know, if there's a way that, you know, that the little money that we have that might be discretionary within Merck can be focused on that, I think that that would be an interesting thing for us to look into and try to recommend based on the presentation that was given to us. I mean, we've got shortages in greater Minnesota. Is there some way that this money can go into addressing those shortages?
Thank you. Let's see, who was next? Dr. Beard.
Green.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to agree. I mean, the formula I'm concerned about, but I absolutely agree, and I have it on the other recommendations. We have to look at primary care and teams. Mm-hmm. And if there's a way to look at that and address it, I think it's a win-win. I just would be concerned that somehow we do something that takes away money. But
yeah.
We want to have, we need primary care doctors and other providers and the teams that we've been working on with Mary and others. So that would absolutely be supported by everything we're doing as well.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Beard?
Madam Chair, first of all, to Dr. Rice's question, actually, we have a pretty supportive environment at the University of Minnesota for primary care. It isn't just me. There are a lot of good people there that understand. We all have teams among physicians, among nurses, among others, and across all those disciplines. So, actually, we're doing pretty well there. I do think we had a wonderful presentation today by Diane Rydrich, and it really explained Merck very well. I agree with the concerns. We don't want to mess with a formula that drives funds out of here. That's not our goal. She listed a series of very good questions.
Right.
And if we could raise those questions within the formula,
like that. Mm-hmm.
That would probably be at least worth trying. Mm-hmm. It doesn't cost anything to redirect internal to the formula funds. Mm-hmm. The second thing to help do that, I'm on two commissions for workforce, this and another, as several other people are. So to coordinate our efforts across the state, I would recommend that we think about setting up a council on, maybe not graduate medical education, but a council on workforce education for healthcare or healthcare workforce recommendation. In Congress, they call it COGME, Council on Graduate Medical Education. Minnesota's better than that. We call it Council on Healthcare Education or Health Professions Education. If we had a state-sanctioned council that spends probably across the decades a focused amount of time assessing the clumsy nature of workforce predictions. We heard about the undulating cycles. That's inevitable in a marketplace we're in. But if there were a commissioned single source that would take time to organize, it's not going to be for next year, over time we could at least have a stab at a workforce plan. We do not have one now. There's an entirely separate group at the University of Minnesota just formed to talk about workforce and on the mission of their accomplishments is to address statewide workforce. There's no way in the world they're connected enough to have a vision of the state workforce needs. But even if they did, it'd be another separate, that's a third group working on workforce. So I think we could organize around some single named entity to help coordinate workforce predictions, and if there is within a formula a way to direct funds, a decade from now we probably will need different workforce. So it's only temporary, it's anything specific. We could do that without new funds.
Thank you. And, you know, that sounds like the kind of thing that could be done through an administration, through the Department of Health, just by executive order, probably establishing it. Senator Lynch and then Ms. Beat.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Dr. Baird, thanks for that comment. And on that note, I would suggest that would be, in a way, that's sort of asking or suggesting that the work of this group is not done.
That's right.
And so if we could incorporate into our recommendations very clear direction, if to no one else other than the administration, that this is this is the tip, I think that would be very helpful to the new administration.
Thank you. Ms. Beath and then Dr. Rice.
Madam Chair, in the relationship to what Dr. Baird said is, I've been appointed to chair the Governor's Workforce Development State Planning Grant that we just received from HRSA, and several of us are on that, and it's about a state workforce planning grant. And when we did some original questions out there during the Health Force Minnesota annual meeting, there was realization from 90 people in the audience that, you know, primary care and providers were key to that. So there might be a way to link some of that work, because Mac's on that, I'm on that, we have a representative from AHEC on that, we've got other representatives from the Hospital Association and other groups, Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, to work on that plan, and that's something that we have to work on through next September. So if that can help.
Thank you. Dr. Rice.
Just echoing that, too, I think that would be good. I think, Mary, if you recall, I think at the end of our work group 2 years ago, I think we kind of said the same thing. There's a lot more that needs to kind of continue on, and it would be nice if there was still some place that it was getting ongoing work.
Yeah, Yeah, thank you. And of course, we're seeing that, as somebody said, it maybe it was Dr. Baird, the nature of the beast is that you're going to have to keep doing this all the time. Mm-hmm. So it should be an ongoing effort. Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. Oh, let's go back to this then. And then we had number six, which was also related to Merck. Redirect the Merck funds to clinics as they become certified healthcare homes. And that, of course, is kind of part of what we were just discussing, whether there might be ways to change the formula to accomplish the goals that we all seem to share. So is there more to say about that particular one? I know several of you were on that. Did you have more to say about it, Dr. Baird?
Only, Madam Chair, only that we don't want to follow up the formula.
No.
Right. Right. Okay. All right. Let's go on then. We had skipped a couple of these. Well, first of all, as I'm looking at this, I think number 8 and number 11 are more or less same thing. I don't know why they didn't get combined, but it seemed to me that they probably should have been. Was I missing something there?
Madam Chair, I think what happened is that just came out of M&A and out of their nursing representative, Dr. Olson and myself had just come together around the APRN issues. So I think we didn't know. Well, the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing.
No, it's not that you guys did anything. It's just that the staff had condensed these down, and a lot of people came at the same sorts of things from different places, and those got put together, but these just didn't for some reason.
Right. But I would say they can just be combined. I mean, it's to remove barriers and to allow people to practice.
Okay. Thanks. Dr. Rice?
Madam Chair, number 11 might bring up a point that we talked about in our previous committee, which was trying to get the understanding that we're trying to collaborate together, not to control or supervise. And perhaps M&A may still want to keep that language in. I'm probably speaking for the other side, if you will, now. But there was some talk of that. I think if you look at our previous report from 2 years ago, and that was my main point, actually, other than just bringing that up because I wasn't prepared to think about that, but that the stuff we're talking about, MMA and MNA, to that's hard to say. it's a pass there. To get those two groups together, what I would maybe like to see stated with that is that I think the framework for that discussion should start from the recommendations from 2 years ago, because I think there's a pretty good framework that I think both parties in concept agreed to at the time, but I think it was the final rollout didn't quite, I don't think, there was interpretational differences in the end that created the problems that I think if we recommended to go back to that starting point rather than starting from scratch.
Sure. Okay.
Would be best. Hopefully they would do that anyway, but it just might be
all
nice
right.
to encourage
Thank
that.
You. And then, Linda Slattengren is not here. So, Ms. Stark, did you want to talk then about, you have this next one anyway, number 12.
Okay, prescription privileges for psychologists, very controversial issue within our profession and across professions. But what I was meaning was that maybe we can think creatively and not necessarily buy into the national model of independent prescription privileges. But because there is such a shortage of psychiatrists here in Minnesota, could we come together and think creatively about some way that, you know, we have this excess of doctoral level psychologists, that there could be some way that they could come together and support primary care where there's a burden. Depression is the second leading cause of disability. You know, could there be prescription privileges within medical homes or within integrated settings? Or, you know, can we be inventive and creative here in Minnesota and that we don't have to abide by anybody else's definition of what training is and to meet people's needs because they're not being met now? And that's what I was wanting to suggest.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Dr. Baird.
Madam Chair, perhaps within the next week or so before you have to write the report, you could get clarification from Dr. Jeff Schiff about what it means to have Minnesota be included in the CMS and Medicaid pilot. We're, again, one of eight states that are collaborating across all eight states. And the goal I've seen, I was only modestly involved, but there are efforts there to create these teams of all kinds, including mental health. That's fundamental mm-hmm. to it. And it could be there to be opportunity within that new permission we have from mm-hmm. CMS to accomplish a lot of these things with nursing and physicians and pharmacists and others. But I don't know the details enough, and Dr. Schiff does. He helped write it. And if there would be some clarification, perhaps even to the authors of what we write, about what might be touched in there that would accomplish maybe a number of items on our list. I actually just don't know.
Maybe that's a recommendation.
But it could open up doorways to lots of team effort. Because
mm-hmm.
we're pilots. We're one of eight states that have healthcare home pilots.
Okay, and maybe we could, I don't know if Ms. Cleveland is going to be in a position to do that, but maybe you could find out about that for us. That would be great. Ms. Chesney?
The one concern that I have, though, is that I think, from my understanding, certainly looking at APRN issues, is that the waivers typically out of CMS or being part of a pilot allows you to sometimes be able to waive CMS regulations. So, for example, the regulation that an APRN can't write for home care orders, for example. What I don't think that type of program is able to do is supersede or override the state's right to yeah. have licensure, scope of practice kinds of statutory language. So I'm not sure. I agree there's going to be added things we can do, but I'm not sure it would get fully at what your concern is. I think the other piece that to be considered is, and this would be true whether it's advanced practice, and I have to say I'm not familiar with what the educational background and ability for us trained doctor of psychology is in terms of medication. But I would again say that we do have that wonderful document from all of the different councils of, you know, Board of Medicine and Nursing and that, the national document, that talks about what the state should use in terms of its criteria to base whether or not someone can do something. And
right.
and so basically it boils down to, is there sufficient education to do it? Are they educated to do it? And then have they had demonstration of being able to safely perform whatever the skill is, whether it's prescribing or whatever, and that there are some set criteria to use. And so, you know, at the risk of not wanting to toss barriers in front of yet another professional colleagues, I would say that probably needs to be used by the state and by the legislature in terms of, you know, how does one look at what kinds of things each of our various professions should be able to do is based on, I think, some pretty common sense kinds of criteria.
And typically, doctoral psychologists get an additional master's degree, and the training is similar to what a PA would get. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was suggesting like a work group or something like that that would discuss this and come up with some recommendations. And it sounds like reviewing that document, but, you know, it's such a controversial issue, and there, you know, but there's such a need as well. And while the trained psychologist probably would meet the criteria, I don't know that would answer the issue in terms of the scope of practice.
You know, and just briefly, in terms of the waiver or possibly having state laws in the way and so on, I mean, this is the kind of thing that, you know, you might need enabling legislation to participate in the pilot that would allow for some, you know, waiver of some state rules just for the purpose of the pilot, too. But, you know, it certainly could be something that we could attempt to do. Dr. Rice, did you have something?
I think one of the cautions I guess I'd raise, and we talked a little bit last time, but just that I think more and more we need to find a way for medicine to be practiced and good health care to be obtained by the patients. There needs to be good coordination of that care.
Yeah.
And, you know, there might be ways to expand that, but I think that the more you create independent parties that can do things, I mean, right now, I mean, there's difficulties within medicine, even with different physicians prescribing all over the place. And we need to
find ways to channel that more and more through one spot so that somebody knows everything they're on and can coordinate that. When we start talking about expanding who's going to do what and opening up the doors there, that sort of runs counter to the need to do that. And I could almost make some of the same arguments I guess I'd have for expanding that could almost be to say, you know, the cardiologist shouldn't prescribe the medicine. They ought to send them to me to take over on that, you know, or at least once they've been established. So I think there's a need to watch the healthcare teams and to make sure that's coordinated through some primary place. Primary care physicians, by and large, are I think, willing to prescribe these medicines. I think a lot of times it is sometimes the lack of knowledge about where are we at, what's the diagnosis, how are they responding to this. I think personally, better coordination of mental health care personnel with the team in terms of even giving recommendation to the primary care physicians or the psychiatrist, if that's who involved, would be much better served to the patient. I know in my previous practice, there were several psychologists I worked with that were very bold about making recommendations for medicines. And sometimes I'd follow them, sometimes I wouldn't. But they gave me their opinions of what they thought should be tried. It was very helpful sometimes.
Right. Against the law in Minnesota.
And I think that sort of thing would be reasonable to address. Because I think for them to bring those kinds of things up to the... Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons it sometimes got to be an issue. But I think that sort of thing is not unreasonable to be addressed. But I think... there's many other areas that need to be addressed when you're choosing the medicine. Mm-hmm. I think as I was talking with, it might have been Dr. Laura, I think after the last meeting we had, there's also, I think, the issue with in psychiatry and psychiatric care, there's an over-reliance on medications to solve people's problems. Mm-hmm. I spend a fair amount of time trying to get people off to counseling. To some extent, there's some benefit to having someone involved with their care who cannot prescribe the medicines and would have to send them back to someone else to get them because getting them to establish a relationship where it's not going to end up with them saying, okay, well, I really want this medicine. This is what I think I need, or I need this other thing there. It'd be much better to have the psychologist be able to say, well, you know, that might be the case. I'll send some notes to your doctor, and you can go talk to them and arrange that. I think it puts a little bit of a check and balance there, not on the psychologist even, but on the patient to sort of separate those out and still develop that relationship to work on the counseling because there are many aspects that are going to be much better served by developing that relationship there.
Right. Dr. Rice, I don't really hear any conflict between what you're saying and what Ms. Stark is saying because I think what's written here, I think she's kind of moved off that. I think what I hear her saying is, you know, not that she's wedded to this, but that she wants to figure out how we can have teams that can maximize the care of the patients.
Yep.
And so I think what you're saying, you know, and her... what I heard her suggest that this be go to a work group of some kind and continue. Yeah. I think there's a lot of potential here, both with the kinds of concerns that you're raising and, you know, how can we just use everybody better to work together as a team? So, you know, if it's okay, I mean, I don't mean to cut you off, but we are a little short on time. You know, what I'm hearing is that we're pretty good with that idea that we can move this forward in some fashion, although it may not be as it's written here on the page.
Yeah. I'm reacting to what's written.
I'm
reacting to what's written. So
I thought that might be the case. Right. So. Okay. So let's see. Let's go to the other side of the page then. And let's see. Linda Slattengren isn't here. Ann Olson isn't here. So, and let's see, Heather's not here. So, let's go down and just, Ms. Stark, if we can just stick with you then and do the ones that are yours, the last four.
Okay.
And so why don't you just talk us through some of these issues?
The first one, 21, I don't know that I can really address. It was just... a plea to find other payment models to have other professionals in primary care settings that are psychiatric prescribers or who can support in that sense because it is so needed. And again, the team approach. Let's see. 22, though it may not explain it well. Currently, psychiatrists can get reimbursed for providing consultation to primary care providers. There may be a role for psychologists to provide consultation about health interfering behaviors and ways, behavioral interventions instead of just about medicine, that may be something that could be useful. The 23 is about having mental health professionals in primary care sites to work on health interfering behaviors, not just on mental health issues, but on the health interfering behaviors, like a diabetic who is noncompliant and working on, you know, what is getting away in the way of, you know, your eating behaviors or taking your insulin or whatever. I was trained in pediatrics, so I have a fair amount of knowledge of those kinds of issues. And I also know that there are some monies, and I think this is what was attached to that. There are some monies that are available for training for psychologists that could be used for this and are currently not being used in Minnesota because some of the approved internship sites feel like it's too much work. And so my recommendation would be that the legislature encourage them to use that money. It's about $100,000 a year that they could use for innovative work in graduate education.
And those funds are grants from whom? Or
I think they're federal grants. And it's for innovative practice. And my idea was that it could be used for a fellowship or a residency with the rural primary care through the School of Medicine in Duluth or something like that, some kind of model. You know, but there's a way to use some of those monies. There are also monies available through PPACA. I don't think they've been funded, but some monies for gerontology and also money for integrated care for training of psychologists. And I think it's important to watch that, and if they become available, to encourage the universities to get access to those funds.
Okay, thank you. I see some heads nodding. And Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, so Ms. Stark, so a recommendation on that area might include, in order to get to this, then what this work group would be actually doing is maybe elevating that to probably the higher ed jurisdiction, so that because we're too siloed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, I sit in here, I go, oh, that's a good idea. I also serve on higher ed. How do I get this mm-hmm. over to higher ed? And so mm-hmm. maybe on this one, we are clear in our recommendation that we are suggesting or we are recommending that the appropriate higher ed divisions take this go forward with this. That'll be the bus to get it there, I think.
Okay.
Dr. Beer. Thank you. Dr. Beer.
Madam Chair, I would reinforce that. I have met previously with the Higher Ed Committee, and it does support graduate education and specifically primary care. In fact, there are state special funds for at least some of the programs. That happens. None of the University of Minnesota programs, but I have championed others that got it before the tobacco funds went away. And I do think it could be in some modest ways tweaked to support interdisciplinary education, not just in our case, not our programs, but others. Family medicine education do have state specials. You could put a phrase or something in there or add a dollar, but tag it to interdisciplinary education of this type. And in fact, we do have fellowships for 2 years to train psychologists to work in medical settings, and we have candidates from all over the country for it. But there's no funding for it. We just do it anyway. It'd be much more widely used if there were even a bit of a tweak in a sentence or two in the state specials that are currently existing that we hope are preserved. We would, of course, like to multiply it, but we're not anticipating that in the near term.
Okay. Okay, and these state specials, I guess it sounds like other people know more than I do about what these are and where they're found and stuff.
So if you put that in the recommendation.
Yeah, so we're going to capture that. Okay, very good. Okay. And then did you want to say any more about any of these, Ms. Stark?
Behavioral health care homes. Currently, behavioral health care homes don't fit the medical home model very well, but for people with serious and persistent mental illness, they may best be served within like a community mental health center where they're already getting a lot of care, and if their primary care could also be added to that, that may be something that could reduce healthcare costs, and it might be useful to recommend a pilot project where a community mental health center is a behavioral healthcare home and provides services like a medical home would provide. I know that there are groups that would like that and have talked about wanting that in legislation, but just haven't brought it forward, like Ron Brand's group. The Association of Community Mental Health mm-hmm. Providers or something like that. As some of you know, people with serious and persistent mental illness die 25 years earlier on average than other people, and they tend not to be real compliant in primary care settings, and it might be a very helpful mm-hmm. kind of thing for them.
Very good. Dr. Baird and then Dr. Rice.
Madam Chair, that might be a place also to look in the federal legislation that was just rewarded to Minnesota. Healthcare homes are established around the country in primarily mental health centers with a nurse practitioner or a primary care physician. And in those cases, maybe 80% of their care is mental health, mm-hmm. but they would be likely to actually receive primary medical services if they have it delivered right in that center. And there are numerous examples around the country that that's done. It's relatively low cost, and it's for that focused population. It's not for everybody else.
Right.
And it actually does lower the mortality rate. There are plenty of studies that show that.
Well, part of the experience from the GAMC change that I learned about was that some of the hospitals, I think, Regions, found that because they offered behavioral health, that they suddenly had the bulk of the, or more than their share of the GAMC population for other healthcare issues because the leading edge was the behavioral health. So I think right there is a demonstration of that those tend to be the very high cost patients as well. And let's see, I had Dr. Rice, and then I'm going to go to Senator Erickson Ropes.
Actually, we've talked about this a lot within the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, and actually, I don't think there would be any problem with that as long as it's functioning as a healthcare home.
Yeah.
That I think if you're setting it up with primary care and taking over the entirety of their coordination, that makes a lot of sense for many of those people. Not necessarily mm-hmm. all that you would be seeing, but there'd be a large portion that may be much better served that way. The issue that we would have is just making sure that it's not carving out a behavioral healthcare home for behavioral aspects that's separate from the other, because we've seen a number of the other specialties in medicine wanting to do that. It's like, well, we'll be the orthopedic medical home, and then we're not really anything different when we've had subspecialized care. But as long as you're coordinating the whole thing, we've talked mm-hmm. about that all along, that, I mean, sometimes an oncologist may end up becoming the medical home for that period because it's much more sensible for them to coordinate everything from that office. So I think it makes perfect sense, and I don't know that it really needs much change in much of what I've seen come through in any of these definitions. I think most of it has tried to leave that open so that it's not defined as a particular specialty, but as a role that people play.
Mm-hmm. Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just speak in favor of this recommendation, too. I remember one anecdotal story that was told to our healthcare policy committee a couple of years ago about a chronically and persistently mentally ill patient whose sister, adult sister, was testifying on his behalf because of his illness. other health care issues had been undiagnosed for years, and back pain and other sorts of things were dismissed as related to his behavioral health problems. And it was discovered too late that he had terminal cancer. And when he was in the hospital being treated as a cancer patient, told his sister, it's so much better to be a cancer patient than a mental health patient. Mm-hmm. And that ought to break every single heart that hears that kind of story. So in a setting mm-hmm. like this, I think we'd be able to deal with the overlapping physical complaints that go undetected.
Okay, thank you. Other questions or comments? We are a little bit over our time. Dr. Rice?
Just real quick, on item 21, I guess I'm not clear, is there a PA with psychiatric specialty role other than working under a psychiatrist? Because PAs usually are working under the auspices of the physician they're working for, so I think that maybe should be simplified just the RPNs with psychiatric specialties. Does anybody know better on that? Because I think generally if the primary care physician is comfortable with them taking on psychiatric roles, that's fine, but it really isn't probably as sensible. I think the idea there is to have someone with more specialized ability in the primary care setting than the primary care physician has to have some latitude, and I don't know that a PA would have that usually.
There are some
Go ahead. No, please.
Madam Chair, there are some PAs that have specialties in primary care or in psychiatric services.
But don't they need to be working under a psychiatrist in their role, I think?
Yes. But, the psychiatrist doesn't need to be on site necessarily.
Okay, so they would be working at the auspice of the psychiatrist within the primary care center. So not
right.
Working. Okay.
Right.
So it's giving, essentially extending the psychiatrist practice, if you
right.
will, the way the PAs would think of it into that
right.
practice. And that I would support that. I was just looking for clarification on that because it
mm-hmm.
didn't quite mesh with my understanding at first there. But
mm-hmm.
I think getting that role into the primary care settings and rethinking it as some of these things address is a very good idea, and having ways of doing that, even like I think we were commenting last time around that, many ways rethinking how psychiatrists are utilized as almost more of a contractual basis would be probably more helpful for primary care. And right now there's not an easy way to account for that in the system, because unless they see the patient, they don't really get paid. And that's probably not the best way to run things.
Ms. Stark?
And, the contractual basis, I think, is really important, because otherwise so much time is spent with the billing of the 10 minutes or whatever, and it just eats up time.
Yep.
And if it's a contractual basis, more time can be spent with patients.
Yeah, because there's from a psychiatric medicine, we could extend the psychiatric care in the state considerably. If, as a primary care doctor, there was a psychiatrist, I could just call for a 2-minute, 5-minute question on a patient rather than set them up for an appointment 3 months from now and deal with it. It would be much more efficient for the patient and would probably solve their needs, except it's hard for the psychiatrist to take lots and lots of those calls without being paid for it. Because
right.
they're already busy and trying to cover things, that if they had time blocked aside just to deal with that sort of thing, it would be kind of nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that strikes me as just that, that of course could, that idea could go a lot of ways too, between a lot of practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, well, Senator Lynch and I are going to work on this and with staff, and we're gonna try our very best to get a draft to you by the 6th of December so that you can get a chance to look at it before we come back together on the 8th and have some discussion about what we've put together. So I hope you all have a very nice Thanksgiving. Thank you all so much again for your time and your expertise and your thoughts, and look forward to seeing you back on the 8th. We are adjourned.